are asking all attendees to adhere to our code of conduct. To summarise, it's please don't be a dick and look out for one another. And basically, thanks for coming along. I'm going to start with Nick, and can you introduce yourself, please?
Thanks. Yeah, hi. I'm Nick Bannell. I'm a writer and lawyer. It's always embarrassing to introduce yourself, so suffice it to say that our friends and comrades at The Guardian recently described me as Britain's top Marxist housing barrister.
Woo! Don't often shout out The Guardian, but well done. Nick, people often think abolishing landlords is some sort of fantasy. Can you talk about how we were close to doing that in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I can let you into a secret, because we're all friends at Bristol Transform. But when I first started thinking about the book and pitching the book, and it was going to have one of those titles like Abolish Landlords or Abolish Rent, and at the time I thought, it's a bit pat, it's a bit ambitious, it's a very typical left-wing book. And then I started writing it, and I was like, my God, we nearly did it. We nearly did it. We came within a whisker. And there was a point in the 70s where not only was landlord decelerating, but the rate at which landlordism was declining was accelerating. And everyone was perfectly happy with this. And it meant that there were more homeowners because landlords were desperate to sell up. And there was more council housing because local authorities were buying those houses from the landlords at bargain basement prices. And it also meant that there wasn't such fierce competition for land. So local authorities were able to acquire more. They were able to build more. And everyone on the left and the right was perfectly happy about this. And like that was the world we could have lived in. That was our future. That was the promise of a previous generation. That was cruelly taken away from us. And Thatcher we blame, but of course we blame Blair as well. Both for the kind of macrocosmic, macroeconomic things he did, but also for the very real things that he and his wife did in the city by popularising buy-to-let as a kind of student investment, by taking the homes that people in Bristol could be living in and landlording them. That is a world in which they created, when we could have been living in a world in which landlordism had all but disappeared. And I think what's like positive about it is that after the Second World War, landlordism as a proportion of housing stock was about 60%. By the mid-70s, it was down to 6%. So it took 30, 35 years for that to happen. It's now taken 20, 35 years to ramp it up again. If we started tomorrow, we could easily abolish it within our lifetimes.
6%.
6%, yeah. Woo!
So the number of dwellings per capita is just shy of the OECD average, but it feels like we only hear from supply guys. Is it as simple as building more homes?
Yeah, no, it's not. And there was a tweet thread doing the rounds over the weekend. The Financial Times' data viz guy, a guy called John Murdoch, Blair Murdoch something, wrote a piece about homelessness in the UK. And the UK is leading the world in homelessness by some margin. It's about 50 households per 10,000. Its nearest competitor is roughly half that, roughly 25. The US is less than 20. And he started the piece being like, what the fuck? We all assume that the US is kind of the homelessness capital of the world, but in fact it's Britain. A huge number of those people live in temporary accommodation and some are genuinely sort of street homeless. But then, so he had this bar chart at the start of this piece, and then he had another bar chart further down that showed that Britain builds more housing than the US. And Britain started off with more housing than the US. And you just think, you know, you're the FT's data guy. If you put two of your own bar graphs next to each other, you would understand that building's not the problem. But of course, he didn't put them next to each other, so he thinks that building's the problem. We have comparable levels of housing stock to many other OECD countries. We somehow managed to lead the world in homelessness. So it's not really a supply problem. And as the left, as Marxists, we need to be in the business of asking better questions rather than just pandering to this undersupply rhetoric.
The one thing the UK is really good at is being the best at the worst things.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always shocked, but
I don't know if there are any stats available, but I doubt there are any other countries in the world where one in every 21 adults is a landlord. We must be leading the world in landlordism, so go us.
Laura and Connor, where are you from? Introduce yourselves.
I'm Laura. I've been an active member of Acorn Bristol for a couple of years now, and I'm the current chair. The Guardian are yet to describe me, but when they do, it would be really good.
Hi, I'm Connor. I'm also Acorn Bristol member, but I live in Bath. I commute in to help out. I'm a left-wing YouTuber, so disregard everything that I'm about to say, because I'm the scum of this country. That's me.
So let's talk about Acorn. Acorn have withdrawn support for the Renters' Bill. That was first brought to Parliament in 2012. How can we force Parliament to reform policy? We still have Section 21, and most elected members are landlords, so how can we force them?
I think, quite simply, we just need to keep piling on the pressure. I think a good thing is that it's quite easily accessible information to find out which of your MPs are landlords, because they have to declare any rental income they make over £10,000 a year. So whilst these politicians, the landlord ones, are clearly very money motivated, they're also pretty motivated by power. And I think the prospect of them potentially losing their seat is just as important to them as the prospect of losing a little bit of extra cash that they make from being landlords. So in terms of pressure, I think direct action is really the way. So going into these constituencies, making sure that the people in their constituencies know exactly where these people's priorities lie, so they know where to vote in the next election and the next time their seat is up. It's a really effective way to apply pressure, but not only that, to keep the community informed of actually the politicians' values that represent them.
In full agreement with the idea that we need to be pressuring the people that are currently at the levels of power, but also ensuring that us both as individuals and in the organisations that we're a part of are putting our weight behind people who do genuinely want to support and who believe in the same world that we ideally want to build. One thing that Acorn has been doing, for example, recently, is we've been getting into contact with our local councillors, and we've been asking them to sign up for some pledges that we have listed to them, improving the local community, making sure that they are funding local youth care, I believe was one of them as well. We had all of the Greens sign up across the board for all five of our pledges, big up. We had Labour as a bloc sign up for all of them except for reopening public toilets for some bizarre reason. I don't understand it. It's so simple. But regardless, and we did approach other people in different parties, and they have also supported. But you're right, like, a lot of the MPs in Parliament at the moment are landlords. We don't know how many, because you have to declare if you make a certain amount as a landlord. If you are a member of Parliament, you don't have to do that if you're a local councillor. I don't believe at this point it's possible to find out if one of your local councillors is a landlord. So that's something that I think is potentially important to look into in terms of ensuring that both nationally and locally we are putting pressure on.
So we hear from supply guys all the bloody time. How can we change the narrative?
Yeah, and just to respond to Connor's point, maybe if Labour reopened the public toilets, we could all stop pissing on them.
Not likely.
You know, the other piece that was in the news at the same time as the bar charts was the Sunday Times Rich List. And one of the new entrants to the Sunday Times Rich List is a guy called Graham King, who runs a company called Clear Springs. And if you do any migrant organising, you'll know that what Clear Springs do is provide squalid temporary accommodation to refugees and migrants. And his company is paid by the government £3.5 million per day for providing slum housing and forcibly moving migrants around the country. And it just seems to me that, you know, this is a state of affairs in which we already outbuild the US, we already have enough housing. So if we built loads more housing but didn't abolish landlordism, Graham King would still be a billionaire and we'd all still be poor. So, like, surely we need to stop Graham King from existing rather than building more housing. That's got to be our enemy rather than, you know, brownfield sites and perfectly pleasant homes that we already live in.
I did make a fire escape announcement at the start, but I feel like I'm going to self-ignite. Some of these statistics are, honestly, they're disgusting. 3.5 million a day for slum housing. Acorn, your take on changing the narrative?
I think changing the narrative is a really interesting thing. Obviously, it's all about talking to the communities that are most affected by these rental increases and being exploited for a need for housing. So their main goals are obviously just to be able to feed their families and not have to be priced out of the communities that they've grown up in and move away from their social networks and family and friends. So again, what we try and do with Acorn is a lot of outreach to get to these communities, find out where their priorities lie and work for them and empower them to create the change. I think the narrative that landlordism is just a nice way to make money is getting quite old with most of us now after all the rent we've paid. And I do think that the narrative is changing, but it needs people power and it needs all of us to stand up and say that this isn't the right way to live.
Sure. I think just to add on to that, I feel that there's a lot of false dichotomy that is wedged between people who have like incredibly similar material needs. And one thing that we do find, and one thing that I think is great about Acorn as a community union is we're bringing together people from throughout the community who have in one way or another been told by mass media that there are people who live next door to them who just want to take their council house off their hands, or there's, you know, it's very important that we rail against that, and we do that both in a rhetorical capacity, but we also do that very much in a material capacity of literally just bringing people together. Which has been truly beautiful to see. Acorn is been part of the organisation for a few years now, and I've been a part of a few left-wing organisations before that, and Acorn has been the one that I've found to be the most people getting together, and, you know, it's helping people. That's the important thing. That, I don't know if that actually answered the question. I do apologise.
I'll just echo what you said in terms of Acorn being such a welcoming space. It's unique in the sense of how well you bring communities together, and it is really admirable what you're all doing. Less local, Housing Action Southwark and Lambeth. So you were leafleting the Southwark's housing office. Can you talk about the impact of those actions and how can we safeguard current tenants when fighting for justice?
Yes, so what had happened was Southwark Council were engaging in this illegal system of what we call gatekeeping, so illegally turning homeless applicants away from the council office by fobbing them off, telling them they needed to do this or needed to do that. And a legal challenge was brought and Southwark lost, and a court order was made by the High Court saying stop being illegal. And of course they didn't, and we thought, well, what do we do? So we would turn up at the housing office, and Southwark were very hostile to this, so whenever they saw us coming, they would shut the security gates and people would be turned away and people would be told that it was our fault that Southwark weren't processing their homeless applications. There was a really hot day once and a very, very heavily pregnant person turned up to ask, where am I going to live when my baby's born? And the security guard said, well, the council's closed and it's those guys' fault because they're here to make sure that you know your rights. And we thought, well, what do we do? And we realised that they couldn't shut the housing office every single day. So we made sure that every single day, at least some people were there. Mm. And it was true. They became used to us, they became inured to us, and slowly things started to get better. And it was just amazing to me as a lawyer that the High Court order was reduced to this fictional piece of paper that had no traction in the real world. And three dickheads with a clipboard were managing to make Southwark better. It's kind of amazing.
More dickheads with clipboards. Acorn run member defence training sessions, and we're really good at mobilising members, and that's to block bailiffs.
Don't know why that came out, I apologise.
But the truth is, not many people know their rights as tenants and renters. How can we broaden the coalition of people fighting for housing reform when renting is so insecure?
I think that one of the great tools that we have at our disposal, one of the two great tools, I should say, one of them is people power, ensuring that one thing that Acorn does, we do a lot of outreach. So that's both going out into the street, we have stalls up. The last stall I was a part of was we were trying to fight to keep the council tax reduction scheme active, and we won that. Woo indeed. But, you know, physically going out into the community, meeting people, having that conversation, letting them know not only their rights, but also that this organisation exists to enforce them when the people who are supposed to enforce them are happy to turn the other way. But we also do loads of phone banking. I, in fact, became an ACOR member because I got phone banked, and I've met other people who I called up who have come to the meeting and they're there because I was the one to be on the phone with them, and that's lush. In terms of educating people as to their rights, the means of communication that we have at the moment is a beautiful thing. Social media and short form video content, such as we can see on TikTok, and also long form that we can see on YouTube and stuff like that, can be really informative, instructive, and can even reach people beyond the original scope or hope of it. To cite Brian David Gilbert as a slight tangent, he recently produced a video, a couple of years ago at this point, about the American healthcare system. And it was incredibly funny, it was incredibly eye-catching, millions and millions of views, but it did also lay bare a lot of the fundamental horrors of privatised healthcare. And it reached far beyond sort of like the intended audience of people who lived in the US. And I think that one thing that organisations like ACORN can do and ought to be doing more of is this sort of like outreach to get into people's phones before they even realise they need to know their rights. And I think that's something that we can certainly bolster up for sure.
We can definitely reach the chronically online. There's a few of us in the room. You also mentioned ACORN stalls. And there's one outside.
Yeah, there is. Go and see it. It's in the garden.
Not now, please stay. Nick, rent strikes. Controversial.
Yeah, so strikes, as lots of you will know, the right to strike, such as it is, was won by the early trade union movement in the very early 20th century. The bosses had been winning in court relentlessly, and part of the reason the Labour Party was created was specifically to reverse those court wins that the employers were winning. When the right to strike was created, it was very, very narrow, and it was a bunch of exemptions to a strike which is inherently unlawful. And obviously those exemptions don't apply to rent strikes. So rent strikes are illegal, but what's dangerous about it is that when tenants tried rent strikes in the 40s, landlords took them to court. And not only did they win, but they established a legal precedent that if a block goes on strike, the landlord can go after the organiser or the tenant who runs it for all of the missing rent, not just the rent that each individual tenant owes. So legally speaking, it's really, really, really shaky. It's really dangerous, and it's got to be done incredibly well and incredibly effectively to get off the ground. But to round off the point with a note of optimism, the reason why I think people in Bristol are capable of being extremely disciplined and working together, being very, very effective, is because I saw you all in the Cayley last night.
Organised chaos. It's what we're good at. Nick, your book, you speak a lot about shame and humiliation regarding landlords. Are they capable?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think the reason I landed on this is because rent strikes are so difficult, one of the best tools we have at our disposal is just, fuck you, this is appalling, why are you doing this? And I think it's interesting, I was watching like a liberal YouTuber talking about how, you know, if only the pension funds knew that they were investing in Blackstone, then the pension funds member would be embarrassed, they wouldn't tolerate it, they would say, no, we don't want to be involved in landlordism. But when I meet landlords in court, a lot of them are saying, this is my pension fund, and I know I'm evicting the person because that's what I'm here to do. Like, they're not embarrassed by it. But that is very, very much a social construct, and it's a recent social construct. Up until Blair came along, it would have been mortifying to admit in public that you were a landlord. Now we live in a kind of generation where there are TikTok influencers telling you how to do buy-to-lets. I was reading a kind of soft soap interview with Mary Earps, the England goalkeeper, the other day, and she was saying that her real hobby, her real passion is her business, and her business is landlordism. Now, she should be mortified to say that in the newspaper, and I feel like that's kind of our job, is to make sure that no one in your presence could admit to being a landlord without feeling that sense of shame. After the Ratlin scandal in the 60s, it became, in the public imagination, this extremely grubby thing, to the extent that one of the country's biggest landlords at the time was the Church of England, and they felt the need to divest pretty much all of their rented housing that was one of the ways in which we came so close to landlord abolition 50 years ago. And it's quite easy to reverse the narrative that's been sold to us through the means of like location, 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 and property flipping programs. We just need the guts and determination to do it ourselves.
I'm still a bit taken aback by the England keeper, but keep supporting the Lionesses, but you don't have to support the men's team. What reform would allow for older people, because Nick did mention a lot of them are relying on it because of inadequate pension funds. What can we do?
I'm probably going to take off my acorn hat and put on my day job hat, which is a financial advisor. And I'd maybe suggest that anyone who is basing their retirement on such unstable investment as a bricks and mortar property has received very, very poor financial advice in their time. So I'm not sure whether it's reform that's needed or potentially just more access to financial education for people. I don't think that properties are a good way to solidify money in retirement, and I don't really know any colleagues that would suggest such a thing. I also think, you know, I know that with care costs being so great, it's a huge concern for people and used as a justification for maybe having some properties.
And uncapped, even though the Tories said they'd bring in a cap on care costs last year, that's, we'll see.
Of course, it's not going to happen. But I would suggest there's a lot of ways you can save money, and tying it up in a property and exploiting someone's need for housing is probably the worst way you could possibly do it. I don't think it's a strong argument at all. I think it's really, really weak. And I don't think we should accept it from anyone that tries to justify their retirement by holding on to multiple properties.
So can we invite you to awkward family Christmases?
I would absolutely love to attend them.
Great.
I mean, do I get a free dinner?
I mean, you might have to fly to Australia for mine, but maybe Connor. Connor, any other thoughts?
I think the only one, I want to go back to this sort of like sense of shame, always a fun topic to return to, because one thing that I've certainly noticed of late, and obviously like Nick has far more experience, like, you know, in front of landlords than I do, but the general air that I'm seeing when you see landlords who are either on Question Time or are being interviewed in sort of vox pops, or posting online, is this sense that they want people to stop shaming them. Like, they feel bad. I think on Question Time 2 days ago, I want to say, there was an older lady who was a landlord who has, you know, multiple properties, and says, "I don't understand why I should feel shame for owning 3 houses. And fundamentally, first off, you don't. but second off, if these people... if shame didn't work on these people to some extent, they wouldn't be complaining about it. And one of the reasons why a lot of our member defences do in fact work is because whilst we do have, you know, some legal recourse, we, you know our rights under certain court orders, bailiffs aren't allowed to physically touch us or move us, so we can block evictions like that, etc., etc. One of the main things that we do, one of the main things that we use to succeed, is this sense of shame, and the sense of, you know, airing one's dirty laundry, posting pictures of these horrible conditions that flats are left in, and like putting them up next door to where the letting agency is. They don't want people to know that. There is a sort of intrinsic sense of shame there that we can absolutely exploit. But obviously, it's going to completely depend on the landlord and the letting agent.
Yeah, I think taking those 2 points together, landlords do often say, "This is my pension." And you couldn't imagine someone coming up to you and saying, "Yeah, my pension is in BAE Systems and American Tobacco," right? Like, we need to make it as unacceptable as that.
So we know MPs, definitely landlords, councillors, maybe. Media class, definitely full of landlords. How can we force a narrative change? These people are shielded from the humiliation.
Yeah, it's funny. The I did a Guardian piece a few weeks ago, which ran very hot for a few days, because I think like an awful lot of people do inherently understand the problem, but hadn't been talking about it for a long time. And when the piece came out, the Guardian wrote to us and said, the numbers are mad, we didn't expect this. And I think even the Liberals are like conscious of just how bad it is, what they're doing. I think part of the problem is like, let's say you're a member of the Tory cabinet, you probably have kids who are renting and renting in horrible conditions and have no hope of things getting any better. So even as like a landlord and a Conservative and a member of the cabinet, you have your own like a clash in your own material needs. You need your children to be okay, but you also need your own buy-to-let portfolio to survive. And at some point, like, the crisis gets so bad that one thing wins out over the other. At the moment, we know which is winning, but it's not impossible for that tide to turn.
I'm going to really try not to swear for this next one. Letting agencies. Not only are they a barrier to direct contact with landlords, some of the questions they ask, it's... I applied for somewhere, this would have been start of the year. They wanted my bank statement, they wanted proof of my income, they wanted my guarantor's income proof. I want to bloody rent a room, like,
yeah,
fuck off. sorry.
You tried really hard, you did really well.
I almost did, I'm really sorry. I can't even read, look at me. Where am I? How can we force letting agencies to change what are really dehumanising practices?
I think the good news is that letting agents, even the biggest ones, are very susceptible to the same kind of reputational damage that landlords are very defensive about as well. Anything that they think could result in a loss of business to them or them being known as the worst letting agent in a city is a really effective move. So one of our Acorn campaigns last year was the Ban the Bids campaign. For anyone that isn't aware, it was about getting letting agents to sign a pledge that said that they wouldn't encourage people to engage in rental bidding. It was all quite vague because there are laws that say, you know, if the landlord wants them to get the highest price, they have to. But it seemed like a completely impossible task to get all of these big businesses who make a lot of money to pledge to something that's going to make them less money. But we managed to get 30 letting agents across Bristol signing the pledge, including one of the biggest ones, CJ Hole.
Mm-hmm. Which...
that clap isn't for CJ Hole, I hope. but it really just proves what we can do when we come together and get out in the community and get the word out about what these letting agents are doing. They are really susceptible to kind of bending to our will if there's enough people power behind it.
I was just saying that I was clapping for CJ Hull. everything, the Ban the Bids campaign. It worked really, really quickly. It worked really, really well. One of the best campaigns that we have run. And we're looking forward to running some more. Hopefully with all your help.
Yeah, I completely agree. And Laura makes a really important point about the kind of legal obligations on lettings agents. They're under something that the law calls a fiduciary duty, so it would literally be unlawful for them not to say to a landlord, look, you could squeeze another 200 quid out of this property if you want to. Their role is to make sure that the market price is constantly realised. In reality, that means their role is to make sure that more and more children grow up in deeper poverty every day. And you sort of wonder how they can look themselves in the mirror and say, yeah, I'm off to work at the Child Poverty Factory today. But we're really good at being alienated from our labour, so we don't always see it. And I think it's brilliant that one of the things that Acorn are doing are rubbing their noses in it and saying, this is what you do. I think in some ways it's a really useful thing to know, because it points out that it's almost impossible, it's almost foolish to demand ethical forms of capitalism because of these invisible duties that make reformism sort of a fool's errand, and really socialism and communism are the only viable options.
Claps for socialism at a socialist festival. Woo! this next topic, I don't know how to answer it. Friend lords. So basically, many of us do know. Many of us know landlords who rent maybe their second room to a friend. Maybe it's less than the local average. But what's their role in the renting crisis, and how should we really view it?
I think this is something that comes up quite a lot in Bristol and maybe in London as well, actually. It's a really tricky conversation to have with friends, and you have to tread very carefully if you want them to remain your friend, because they get very defensive. But it is important to remember that even if you are renting a room from one of your friends and the rent is quite cheap, you are buying or helping them buy a tangible permanent asset for themselves without reaping any benefit of that asset for your entire future, but spending some of your money on rent so you can't save up to buy one for yourself. There's also a huge power imbalance there, because your friend, no matter how much they like you, is always the owner of that house and will always have ultimate power over what you do when you live there, which I think can cause a lot of stress and anxiety for people that we don't talk about enough, especially with these friends who are landlords. Obviously, the cost of living crisis has hit everyone, and we should probably, everyone here should have a better standard of living than we're experiencing right now. We should all be able to go on holiday. We should all be able to go traveling when we want, but we can't. But in my mind, there is no justification for directly exploiting someone's need for housing to achieve a better standard of living. And I often think and wonder what makes these friends who are landlords think that they are more entitled to that better standard of living than their friends that are living in their houses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I fundamentally agree. And also there is that spectrum of, for example, back when I was living in London, I sublet from somebody who was themselves renting, and the legality of that is, we had to, because me and my partner at the time, we couldn't have afforded to have stayed in London on the salaries we were on, and the people that we were subletting from couldn't afford to rent that house. It's London. And that was a very difficult and a very tense situation to be in. Obviously, it's a shared space, but there is still that sort of like hierarchical difference between one set of people and the other. But I sort of contrast that in my mind of like, okay, we've got two groups of people who are struggling together in one way or another. And I think to my very first member defence case with Acorn, which was someone attempted to extract an apology from their landlord after they'd effectively been bullied. It was a live-in landlord, effectively been bullied out of their property with a series of incredibly abusive post-it notes that they were just finding on all of their stuff when they returned home from work. You know, there'll be post-it notes on the inside of cupboards being like, "Don't you dare touch my fucking..." We've already broken the seal on
Sorry.
I apologise. "Don't you dare touch my fucking pots," and stuff like that. Or like, you know, she would come home a few hours later than like normal from work, because she'd gone home to gone off to have drinks with friends, and she'd find a post-it note being like, "Don't you dare come in loud ever again," stuff like that. That's completely different situation, incredibly imbalanced situation to be in. We and the member defence case we actually ran with that was, we turned up to the letting agency, his business which he ran, and we left a bunch of post-it notes all over the front of his business, which was very cathartic. It's very nice. I left the Pride March for that, and then I went back in. It was lovely. There is nuance to it, but at the same time, exploitation is exploitation.
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine being friends with someone if they've got the finger on the switch of your life support machine, right? They're capable of withholding and taking away from us a thing that we desperately need. And I think this kind of relationship will be recognisable to anyone who works in the third sector or for a left-wing organisation, that there's a deliberate attempt to dissolve the class conflict, to dissolve the different things that you need from each other. And your boss will typically say to you, "Well, you don't need to join a union," or "We can't afford to pay you because we're all comrades here, it's a small organisation," and it just, you know, you end up leading a shit life because someone's obscured from you the class conflict that's inherent in the situation. I think what's interesting about it is that it's important not to be moralistic about it and to be personally moralistic about it. And I think certainly Marx would be much more interested in what is the state of affairs that has led to my friends exploiting me for rent, rather than is my friend personally a dickhead, because of course I didn't know there was a no swearing rule. I feel like we've got an out of hand now, but it's often not their fault. And I feel like it's the same thing with gentrification in a lot of ways, that like people who move into a working class area can't afford to live in a nicer area or a wealthier area anymore. They're as subject to the flows of the housing crisis as anyone else. So it's about pointing at and understanding the mechanics of the situation, more than just screaming at people who also find themselves needing somewhere to live.
I might be a little bit late, but a language warning for this session. I've intentionally tried not to do too many questions because I do want to open it up to the audience. But before we do, let's end on a bit of hope. Can you share the best win you've been involved in and how you got there?
Yeah, for me, I think definitely the Ban the Bids campaign we did. It just felt like such a mammoth task at the start. And one of the great things about Acorn is that it's such a diverse group of people with different time constraints and different skills. And seeing so many people come together and give what they can to that campaign with research, with direct action, it was a really incredible thing to see. And the win was so, so huge and has hopefully changed things for a lot of renters in the city. There's a lot more work to be done, of course, but it was a really great thing to see. And, you know, I implore you, no matter how little time you have, if you can join Acorn Bristol and be a part of that in the future, it's the most fulfilling thing.
And if you don't have time, you can be a member and pay them.
Mm.
Just something to think about.
Come on. There's a bucket at the back. No. I think the one for me was the council tax reduction scheme, which was instituted in 2017 by the council, and they twice tried to get rid of it, and Acorn and other individuals and organisations fought against that, and twice we stopped them from getting rid of it, and they then patted themselves on the back for having not gotten rid of the thing that they put on the slate to get rid of, and of course didn't give any credit to Acorn. But that's been in effect since 2017, so we're past like half a decade now, and I think we are, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we are the last remaining major city with that scheme in effect, which demonstrates the power of people. Power, couldn't think of a synonym for power fast enough. But yeah, like that for me has got to be the biggest win. And, you know, doing outreach for that and talking to people and, like, even, you know, letting them know that this was a thing that was on the chopping block, or even a thing that existed that they didn't realise was the official reason why their council tax had been so low, was really great and wonderful to actually, like, communicate with people about that.
And if you want to hear more, just complete delusion, where the council want to take credit for Acorn work, feel free to listen to the Neil Maggs interview with Tom Renard. Disclaimer, he did not do what he said he did. That might have been Acorn. Nick?
Yeah, legal wins often feel quite hollow. It's always very funny when a landlord loses in court. It costs them a lot of money. But the reason it feels hollow is that litigation inherently involves taking away someone's voice in their agency and forcing the dispute to be professionalised and mediated through the languages of the court, and it's quite hollow. But what we've done with Hassel is we spend an awful lot of our time making sure that people get allocated council housing.
And Hassel, can you
Housing Action Southwark and Lambeth, sorry. And every time somebody moves into a council home, it's extremely moving. It's a life-changing moment because they move from a site of exploitation and poverty into a site of generational security that their family could live in for up to 100 years, paying a lower rent with security. And the weird thing is, it could be in the very same building, but due to the legal, one's a private lease, one's a social lease. Mm. So those fights, those day-to-day wins, seeing people get their keys to their council home is phenomenally moving.
I am going to open it up to the audience, but I am going to ask you to stand up if you have a question, because I literally can't see you. If you do have a question, jump up. I've still got time, don't worry. Let's just go start to front to back, because we've got one mic, sorry.
Thank you very much for your very interesting talk. I'm quite curious about the massive gap we have between so-called reformist actions that are trying to make appeal to the better nature of landlords and this Christian shame, and the gap between that and we need to build social housing and socialism or communism. Where in between those two is the strategy that we should to decommodify housing?
Mm.
So in Bristol recently, there was the temporary accommodation provided by quite a large organisation called Connolly Callaghan, which they can be familiar with. The conditions in Connolly and Callaghan accommodation were appalling, really terrible, and very, very restrictive rules in that accommodation as well. It particularly affected people who were in temporary accommodation, which didn't have it for a very, very long time. As a result, Bristol Council tried to work with Connolly and Callaghan to change those rules, and in response, they pulled that out of the market in Bristol, providing temporary accommodation to Bristol City Council, and instead provided those units of temporary accommodation to other neighbouring councils instead. So I guess my question is, how can we respond to these incredibly powerful market forces at the lower end of the market? I mean, I know you were saying that there is enough supply, but the fact is that the competition is all at the lowest end of the market. This slum housing that's provided for the most vulnerable in society, and the organisations who provide the society have a huge amount of economic power, because they can withdraw these services if any pressure is put on them to amend these conditions, and simply to provide it somewhere else, because there's so much demand everywhere. So how can we respond to that huge amount of economic power that these slum houses have?
Just one more and then we will go through them.
So, I'm curious to hear people's thoughts on how where housing co-ops and other kind of alternative models of home ownership fit into it. Sometimes I've been saying up in NMOS, and I was astonished at how little I knew about all of the different structures that exist out there. I've been talking to people like, what is this? Mm. So yeah, I'm curious to know where you guys see things like housing co-ops fitting into all of this situation.
Okay, let's start with the first one. Reform,
can I answer them in reverse order, is that all right? Can I be
wrong?
Let's do it. Housing co-ops, I coming from London, I'm very cynical because it would be impossible to start one because it's impossible to acquire the land. But what I would say is that this process of decommodification that I'm arguing for is what would enable housing co-ops and alternative forms of living to evolve. How do we want to live? Are we interested in family abolition? Are we interested in co-living? These are all questions that we can begin to answer a lot more thoroughly once we're no longer competing with the landlords for the land. On the very shrewd question about the market at the bottom end, it's a really important point, and I think it's a travesty that temporary accommodation bills are driving large cities into bankruptcy. Birmingham, Nottingham are losing 100% of their cultural funding. All of the things that make life worth living are no longer possible because the state prefers to pay landlords. Mm. Now, if we rent capped all temporary accommodation and all accommodation, it would be impossible for landlords to play those games. It would feed into a system in which we slowly drive landlordism into the ground, and then there would therefore no longer be a need for temporary accommodation anyway. And I think I would say the same thing to the first question about landlord flight and bigger aims, because I think they're sort of the same thing. The way you decommodify landlordism quite easily through things like rent control, through things like interest rates, you make it more difficult for them to turn a profit. And that's how the market becomes cooler. That's how the market becomes decommodified. So I think there are very, very radical potentials contained within very, very modest demands.
Pick your order.
God, back to front or front. Okay, we'll go with co-ops first, because I think, co-ops are obviously a bit more of a popular thing in Bristol. And they're a really good idea, and I think people should look at alternative ways of living together. But I think at the very core of this crisis, what we need to get back to is just people being able to afford to live on their own if they want to live on their own, especially working class families and communities might not always want to share a home with a lot of other people. And I think we've got so far into the crisis now that people are just looking at co-ops because things are so unaffordable, which isn't necessarily the right way to look at it. You know, we should all be able to live as we want, and if a co-op is what we want, then that's what we should go for. But in terms of like the intricacies of co-ops, it's not something, even as a Bristolian, I know much about, which I know is really bad. But I think we need to kind of switch the narrative anyway and look at why so many people are looking at co-ops in the first place and why there's a need for it. there anything you want to add to that one?
Yeah, I think that it's the idea of sort of like revolutionary housing and looking at how we can actually sort of like liberate the way in which we live is a fascinating topic. And I know that there are many places around the world where you are seeing these sort of successes. I think Amsterdam immediately springs to mind. I must admit, I'm not as well versed as I would love to be, but it would be fantastic to see these radical experiments being able to flourish in a place like Bristol. And I hope that they can do so in a situation where organisations like Acorn or political parties that genuinely have the best interests of the majority of people who live in this city are able to provide a baseline of care and housing so that we can like experiment with these really cool forms of living. That's what I would say to that one in particular. Did you want me to do the middle one or?
I'll just quickly add, I am going to play the foreigner card for why I'd never heard of housing co-ops until I moved to Bristol, in the same way I'd never heard of white people playing the didgeridoo until I moved to Bristol.
Or white shamans.
Yeah, I'll leave it there. Temporary accommodation.
I think Nick's right. In terms of temporary accommodation, there's huge reform to be had with the way this whole market works. I think whilst we wait for that reform to happen, and I don't think it's that far away, it's really just getting feet on the ground. I don't think these temporary accommodation providers are immune to reputational damage. They are similar to big letting agents companies, and we've seen before that direct action works and shaming them works, and getting the word out and having actions at their place of business and letting everyone know what they're doing really holds them to account and makes them want to do better. Not because they care about the people that are living there, obviously, but because it looks bad. And if that's the only tool we can use to exert some power and bargaining tools over them, then that's just what we've got to do until there is reform.
I think that it's very scary that such large corporations can effectively hold hostage the most vitally necessary emergency shelter, and the idea of taking them on is, I mean, it's, you know, it's not Leviathan. It's something that we can absolutely do, but the methods that we are going to have to employ in order to actually beat them are going to still be learned. I don't know if we as an organisation have taken on temporary accommodation, businesses before. I can't recall. It might have happened before I became a member. But I think that the fact that they can, at the drop of a hat, just leave is absolutely terrifying. And I think it's something that like we as an org should probably be looking into, if not for like immediate action, but certainly for like future action, because that's horrifying.
No, brilliant questions. And also just to say, Laura, Connor and Nick will all be outside at the end as well if you do want to chat more. But let's get some more questions, please.
We had the last one. The one.
More questions, please. At the back and on the right. Sorry, can you hold the thing?
Okay, so you're talking about landlords, obviously, but for people, it's supposed to be where people have inherited their mother's property or their aunt's whatever, and turn around and then do it up and then rent it out. I'm really asking, are there any good landlords? Is there any circumstances where someone rents out as a good person? And particularly those people are likely to do a lot of effort into it and maintain it. Whereas, obviously, there are lots of people who slum landlords, you know, if properties rented, they would just be sold to a slum landlord as a relatively principal business. But just, you know, are we blackening all landlords without exception?
On the right, please.
Hi, my question is on anything that you could share on reflections on procurement of stuff like council housing and broadly government-owned subjects, quote unquote, housing, whether permanent or long-term. I recently kind of learned about problems with temporary housing for prison leavers and kind of the challenge of providing a stable exit for people leaving prison, how when they don't have the access to that housing, the likelihood that they are going to return to prison is higher. And so any kind of reflections on and the problem there being that the government struggles to procure that housing to then provide it. Any reflections on government procurement processes and stuff like that?
I'm going to rephrase it just as council housing procurement, because if I talk about prison reform, we'll be here. Let's not get started. And then just one final one, please.
Do you think for the growth of we're just going to see a process where that stands?
Sorry.
What is the sole accumulation of the growth of tenants you need? So bit by bit, new branches doing this happen here and everywhere. And somehow, I wonder, is it we continue on the same kind of scale of pace, and somehow we get to a point where we've abolished landlords, we built social housing? Or is it, I feel like somehow there has to be some kind of rupture, or some major event, like quantitatively change things, in a way that's kind of like, it's not just Acorn scales and everything we have, does it have to be some kind of like big,
thank you. Just to start, Laura, would you like to talk on the good landlords question?
Yes, I'd love to. In my opinion, there is no such thing as a good landlord. If someone has inherited a second property and is holding onto it but not living in it, that begs the question of why they are doing that. And obviously the core of the answer is that they are looking to make profit off someone's need for a home. They are exploiting someone's very basic human right to boost their salary, essentially. I would also say, obviously, having a landlord that just owns one extra home and is renting it out, there are arguments that they're nice landlords and, you know, they're not just looking to profit like a big corporate machine. But at the same time, do they have the skills and resources and knowledge to be providing something as important as housing to the general public? I would argue absolutely not. And there is absolutely no reason why they should keep hold of a second property that they're not utilising themselves.
Devil's advocate, which I hate, but I'm going to do it. Often people will come back on that and say, well, if I sell it, they could be a shit landlord. How do we tackle that?
Well, they could also be a shit landlord themselves. So, I mean, how are they proving that they're going to be a better landlord than whoever buys that home? I just think it's such a ridiculous argument. And if you sell the property, you're freeing it up to someone that might be able to buy it. If there are more properties available, house prices wouldn't be so insane. More of us would be able to actually own a property in our lifetime. It's just adding to the crisis. With a nice excuse over it to say, but I'm a nice guy. I'm not going to kick someone out for no reason.
Nice guys are a myth.
Just really that sort of like it is a nice fairy tale that one would tell oneself that, oh, if I had the good graces to be gifted a property, that I would be, you know, I'd be that kind person that charges below market rent and I'd actually do repairs. And when you compare a good landlord, quote unquote, to a bad landlord, then absolutely you can see that, you know, you would prefer to live with a good landlord. They're still taking your money each month and you're not getting anything out of it other than not dying of exposure. So, like, No, I don't care between the false dichotomy of like the good prison guard and the bad prison guard. It's still a prison, baby. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, when you have a market in which people are paying 50% of their incomes on rent, if there are good landlords, they are statistically irrelevant. They are a rounding error. And the fact that we should be talking about them in a broader debate about landlordism is, I think, laughable. We know that landlordism is a massive economic harm. We shouldn't be talking about the statistically irrelevant ones who might be charging below market rent. The other thing I'd say is a friend of mine recently had some quite bad mould in her flat and complained. And to her shock, the landlord came round and cleaned the mould off. And she started to think about it and she was like, are they doing that to make sure that I don't die? Or are they doing it because they're gearing up to re-let it? And when there's the permanent imbalance, we don't know whether the good landlord is being good or whether they're about to screw us over. And until that changes, then yeah, I'm not interested in talking about good landlords.
Yeah.
Council housing procurement.
Yes. And again, we can learn the lessons of history for this. The landlord abolition moment in the 70s was largely a moment of acquiring homes from distressed landlords who couldn't make a profit. The state was giving grants to local authorities to sell up. So when the state is, I mean, if I were running a nice council, I would not want to build council housing because it would be sold off in 10 years' time. You put all these public resources into something, it's then privatised, and you know, where are you going to get the money from in the first place? Until we abolish landlordism and make it possible for local authorities not to have to compete with developers and with profiteers, it's just a massive waste of public money, which will eventually be privatised.
Sorry, after you.
Go for it.
Oh,
he's ready. He's not.
No, I was desperately trying to find a quote. Private Island by James Meek, by the way, great book. But yeah, the issue, obviously, right to buy. Thank you so much, audience. appreciate that. God, I should have known that. But yeah, like, obviously the mass sort of purging effectively of council house stock has had disastrous implications for us far down the line, and you know, even immediately afterwards. And I think one of the and again, really, really enjoy this text. It's not just about housing, but about privatisation in Britain in general. But some of the interviews that Meek runs with people who did sell off their council house, they assumed that what was happening was that money was going back into the council so that they could procure more council housing. They assumed that it was going to be this sort of cyclical thing, and they were effectively duped into engaging in this incredibly predatory market practice. What needs to happen absolutely is further council house procurement. That's not going to happen under the Tory government, and doubtful that's going to happen under the Labour government. And so one thing that we absolutely need to be focusing on is ensuring that we're putting our weight behind the kind of politics that is going to allow that to happen, or is going to force that to happen, as needs may be.
Who knows? Keir Starmer might come in and be radical.
I have a hat somewhere and I will eat it.
Nick, can you answer the third one for
us? Yeah, the third one was about rupture, and it's a really, really interesting question. On the one hand, I'm despondent, because if Awab Ishaq wasn't a moment of rupture, if Grenfell wasn't a moment of rupture, the incidents of mass death and child death don't wake people up to the housing crisis, then you wonder what will. On the other hand, I think it's, again, really important to reach back into history and remember how few allies landlords naturally have. Right-wing conservatives hate landlordism because it's economically wasteful. Britain spends £65 billion a year on rent, a third of which comes from the state. And you wonder if in any other context, the IMF would intervene. The IMF would come in and say, this is wasteful public spending. And I wonder, in a perverse way, if there isn't a useful moment of rupture where we say to the Daily Telegraph, you hate landlordism, we hate landlordism, let's knock it out of business.
Absolutely unholy alliance.
Yeah. Where's the hat?
I'm
going to
find it.
Where's the mic, please? Tony. So Tony is from The Land Is Ours, Just going to invite him to quickly
announce. Thanks ever so much. First of all, the election is at an all-time high, right? And most people would have noticed some really good stuff in the national papers talking about the numbers of the election. This is an incredibly long struggle. You go back to the English Civil War, the Diggers, you go to the Irish Hand League in the 1880s, who started the successful campaign to make the Irish Republic, to get away from the British Empire. So it goes back a long, long way. We have in Bristol here a group called Bristol Housing Action, which is been going since the 1980s, the squatting support group. And I myself was a squatter before I got into a housing association flat a few years ago. So I think for us as a group, we're housing something like 150, 200 people in squatting emergency accommodation, just to get a roof over their heads. People that know the city will also know there's a massive encampment up on the downs of people living in vehicles. I mean, something has got to be done to address this problem. I think there's a housing bubble, obviously. This is because one of our basic human needs has also become a place where people just speculate with money and invest their money. And these two things are totally incompatible. So what we've done as a group is to launch on the 1st of May this campaign to abolish eviction.
Mm.
Now, people may remember during COVID, the government did stop eviction. And I'd just love to hear from the panel, do you think it's possible?
Absolutely, and it needs to happen. That's the end of my statement.
It was on the Renters Reform Bill, but was it Gove that took it off? Yeah.
Yeah. So that form of security was the successful type of housing rights that governed most of the 20th century, that exists in most sensible countries worldwide. Britain is extremely weird not to have any security of housing and not to have any form of rent control. We're an aberration and we need to put an end to it.
Mm.
The only other thing I'll add is people who are living in caravans, because they don't have access to housing, is a problem. But people who choose to live in caravans, by all means, they need more support and they need more protection.
Yeah.
The amount of times you just see cops just harassing them over...
Yeah.
Let's leave it there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to wrap up. If you do have more questions, the good news is Acorn have a stall outside. Guess what's on the same stall? Also, just to quickly add... Nick has some of his books here, which you are welcome to buy. 20% off! genuinely, it is an excellent book. And Laura, I know you've read it.
Yes, yeah, it's
genuinely
great.
Genuinely excellent. Not just saying that, because he sat there. So please come chat to us. We'll head outside, buy the book. It's on offer. And just thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you